Stay tuned for Juno Afternoon. It's next. We'll be talking about Juno Jazz and Classics and what remains of that series. We'll talk with Molly Porter from Head Start and Nikki Love from AEYC about the push for early enrollment. We'll learn about Kids to Park Day with Sean Isley of Discovery Southeast and Sarah Tarver from Juno Parks and Recreation. And we'll get a preview of Wednesday's town meeting about Juno's waterfront development with Chris Myrtle from Corvus Designs. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. That's next on Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The St. Regis Mohawk Tribe is reaching out to doctors in Cuba for help in treating diabetes. North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein has more.
People with diabetes can get foot ulcers, and they can get so bad that toes or the whole foot have to be amputated, and that can devastate diabetics and their families.
Loss of life, loss of productivity in the community, and just the personal shock and trauma.
Beverly Cook is chief of the St. Regis Mohawk Tribe, which straddles the U.S.-Canada border in upstate New York. She led a delegation to Cuba, where doctors pioneered a new treatment for the ulcers. It's called Heberpro-P. The medicine's used in 24 countries now, but it's only being tested in the U.S. Cook says Indian countries should lobby the federal government to approve the medicine and provide funding for tribes to buy it.
We don't want Indian people to be left in the dark about it or to be not able to access it due to the budget constraints of Indian Health Service.
Cook says the Mohawk delegation also learned about Cuba's excellent preventative public health program. She says Native tribes can identify with Cuba's effort to care for its people in the face of dominant U.S. power. For National Native News, I'm David Summerstein in Canton, New York.
Statistics show the dental health of young Native Americans is particularly bad compared to other groups. As Steve Jackson reports, efforts are underway to find out why that is and seek solutions.
Native American children have an unusually high rate of tooth decay. The problem is shown in figures for the number of kids that are admitted for dental work and serious office visits that require surgery compared to young people of other demographic groups.
The rate for the country on that overall is something less than 4 in 1,000 children. The rate in many Indian communities is greater than 200 per 1,000 children. In some communities, is over 500 per 1,000, meaning half the children.
That's Dr. D. Robertson, who heads the group QUEST, which stands for Quantifying, Understanding, and Eliminating Severe Tooth Decay in American Indian Alaska Native Children. Robertson says the reasons behind the problem are not clear-cut.
We're almost sure it's not genetic. There's something complex going on, and we know that in the Indian communities where a lot of children have this, if you grow up there versus, say, growing up in whatever, you know, suburb of Spokane or something, you're at a different risk. The same child would be at a different risk. It's multiple factors.
Robertson says one approach that's seen some success in treating tooth decay is an older technique using silver nitrate to treat decaying teeth rather than surgical procedures. Dr. Robertson says efforts continue to determine causes and potential ways to prevent the dental issues, including collaboration between dentists and doctors and literally over 100 projects to study different approaches. I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
As powwow organizers and business leaders in Albuquerque, New Mexico, look for a new space to host the Gathering of Nations next year, some people who've long took part in the event are not too concerned about a venue change. Earlier this month, after 3 decades of support from the University of New Mexico, university officials announced the end of hosting the powwow, citing financial and operational concerns. The gathering draws people from across the country and Canada, including powwow MC Ruben Littlehead, who says he looks at the decision in a positive light.
The energy and just the, you know, the crowd in there might be a little bit different, you know, to adjust for maybe for the first year or two. UNM, you know, I thought they had a good thing going there, you know, as far as awareness and as far as hosting, you know, the largest powwow. I mean, there's going to be a new venue and gathering will always be there.
Organizers say the powwow draws thousands of people and brings in millions of dollars to Albuquerque. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who've had their day one at nativenews.net. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Thank you for joining us for a Juno Afternoon. I'm Lori Scantling with our producer, Jeff Brown. Our first guests this afternoon include Kathy Ruddy. She is chair of the Juno Jazz and Classics Board, and with her are two professional percussionists, Dwayne Corbin, who was a resident conductor here in Juno not too long ago and who teaches at Simpson University in Redding, California, and is the conductor of the Shasta Orchestra, and his wife, Corinne Corbin. We are going to talk about some performances that are rounding out the amazing three-weekend series of Juno Jazz and Classics. Welcome to all of you. Kathy, rundown? There's a percussion at the center of the next few days, so tell us what the schedule is.
We have this extraordinary group, Third Coast Percussion from Chicago, and the Third Coast is Lake Michigan, I learned when listening to your show. And they are performing tonight at 7 at the Jack, a full concert, including a John Cage, an amazing third construction piece. But first, in about an hour and a half, we have a free rush hour concert by the President's Own Marine Jazz Band Combo, and they were just at the SOB. Mm-hmm. They're so wonderful. They're extraordinary. So that's free concert at the Jack, starting in about an hour and a half. And you have to go park. Whittier is only one way. You can't go down Whittier, so you have to be creative about finding a place to park. So that's our free rush hour concert. But then at 7 tonight is the Third Coast full concert, an extraordinary quartet of young percussionists who are also choreographing the John Luther Adams epic performance, Free Outdoors, Saturday at 2 o'clock. Okay, so back to the schedule. Tonight, the Third Coast Percussion, 7 p.m. at the Jack. Then tomorrow night, also at the Jack, we have Roman Kim, the phenomenal young violinist, Russian-Korean, and Maxim Pakhomov, Russian extraordinary pianist as well. That's tomorrow night at the Jack at 7. And if you YouTube Roman Kim, you will see he has several videos that have had a million hits. I mean, he's an extraordinary technician. Paganini is his idol, and yet there's a sense of drama that just draws people. So that's 7 o'clock tomorrow night at the Jack. We are not sold out. You can get your tickets at the door. Then Friday night, also at the Jack, we have the dance party, the Rad Trads, a young group of quartet, maybe five, I'm sorry, and I forget where they're from, but it's just wonderful traditional jazz and modern jazz, but danceable, you know, clarinet, cornet, trombone, and rhythm. So that's Friday night, also at the Jack, also 7 p.m., and we have not sold that one out, so you can buy tickets Friday night. And then Saturday, our finale is Mavis Staples at Centennial Hall, and I assume it's 7 o'clock. Hold on. I don't know if we're selling that one out. 7:30. Mavis Staples Saturday night is at 7:30. It's always good to get your tickets online, but I don't know if we're going to sell that one out. All right. So that's the rundown of the immediacy, and then I would love to turn it over to Dwayne and Corinne so that they can talk about this epic outdoor 75-minute free performance Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock across the beautiful campus of the University of Alaska Southeast, better known as UAS. And remember on that one, too, you can't come in the chapel by the lake entrance. You have to go around up the hill from DeHart's go around the roundabout about halfway, and that's the interest. That's the access there. I want to read one sentence and then turn it over to Duane and Corinne. Adams, John Luther Adams, and this is a Pulitzer Prize-winning Alaskan composer. It's an epic composition for large percussion ensemble. It is, as I say, 75 minutes, and it is outdoors, and it is free.
And it can accommodate and include 9 to 99 percussionists. And I know
this
because I watched a portion of Inexuit online, and it was a stunning, beautiful, large audio onslaught of amazing sounds.
Audio onslaught, that's a great description of it.
So Duane and Corinne, we were talking about some misperception of what percussion is. I picture people banging drums, and yet we spoke with a Third Coast member yesterday who started us thinking about there's such a variety of percussion. Talk about that a little bit and the kinds of instruments that each of you play as professional percussionists.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of people think of percussion, and their first thought is either the snare drum that the small child is beating on, or a drum set with a band, like a jazz band or a rock band. And those are typically the things that people think of first. But percussion encompasses a wide, wide number of instruments. I loved, actually, John Luther Adams in his introduction to Inuksuit was talking about how percussion encompasses everything, including the kitchen sink. So we play
literally.
We play on a lot of traditional instruments. We play on a lot of found instruments. And we often will create instruments out of just different items that have great sound to them. So personally, I'm a classically trained percussionist. My primary instrument in the orchestral setting would be the timpani, so those big copper kettles that you think of in the back. And then my primary solo instrument would be solo marimba. But I play everything else under the sun.
Duane, talk about your favorite percussion.
Sure. It's hard to have a favorite because I think one of the things that's great about percussion is how many different genres it exists in. And I mean, I love playing orchestral music, and so that I'm going to gravitate more towards maybe the xylophone and glockenspiel and snare drum, these sorts of things. But I love playing drum set as well in all sorts of different kinds of ensembles, and it connects to a different audience when you're playing different styles of music. That's what's great about jazz and classics, the series that we're part of, is that it's not stuck on one genre. You have everything from Dixieland to this great traditional violin, piano, duo concert, and everything in between. Even hearing the President's Own Band this afternoon, hearing the jazz group, they're playing funk tunes, and they're playing, you know, some Latin music, and they're playing old-time jazz and new jazz, and it's just this huge diversity. And so percussion allows us to experience all of that and to be able to participate in that. So that's what's a lot of fun for me.
So it sounds like there are about 60 participants signed up so far.
I hadn't heard the latest number, so that's amazing.
To participate in Inuksuit on Saturday, again, which is 2 o'clock outdoors at the UAS campus. This might be kind of a naive question, but could anybody play something percussive as part of this gathering?
I can answer that. No, it's scripted. It's written out. The music is written out. And there is a rehearsal. There's a mandatory rehearsal on Friday.
Right.
And if you haven't been invited, Ed Littlefield is coming also. Yeah, Ed Littlefield from Sitka. If you haven't been invited yet, over the last 4 months they've been assembling people, you need to call Reggie at the Jazz and Classics office, 463-3378, and she will put you in touch with Sean Connors, who is the leader of Third Coast. It has an element of formality that requires, there's a structure, and people will be able to walk around and listen as they will. It incorporates the natural setting, but it's not willy-nilly. Okay, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, it's fine. There's sort of three categories of player in the composition in terms of Adams divides us into sort of three camps. And group two and group three are more written for percussionists who might have more experience on hitting more complex instruments. Group one is really does not have any traditional technical challenges of percussion, at least that's my impression, as we look for it. Although that one actually has a lot of brass instruments, there's an option for blowing through conch shells or through using a trombone or a trumpet just as a percussive effect, blowing wind through it. So one of the things that's great, I mean, I don't have all my instruments yet. I have to go down to the beach and get two big rocks. Because there's one point that I'm supposed to be, you know, rubbing two rocks together as one of my instruments. So it's a collection. We'll have a pile of eight drums for me, large to small tom-tom or bass drums. But then we'll also have these interesting instruments, and we have to go to Home Depot to get Corinne a flexible piece of tubing that she's going to swing through the air.
And I know that there are four Glockenspiels as part of this, and also there's a World War II air raid siren that we've been on the scout for the last month and a half.
That's good.
I have no idea whether we've come up with that yet.
It's a hand crank. I've seen it in the videos.
Did you hear whether we got that or not?
I have not heard.
I'm sure they brought one with them. But so if you're in the area and you don't know what's going on, you hear an air raid siren, don't panic.
It's not terribly loud, and it's amazing how it is part of, I said, that oral onslaught. Mm-hmm. So, Corinne, what are you playing for Inixuit?
So, my part, I'm in group three, and that has seven suspended cymbals and a gong, and then, of course, the Aeolian instrument, the tube that is swung around. So, that'll be more of a wind effect, and then the cymbals and the metals. And then, I'm in the end, the Glockenspiel is used to play bird songs. So, John Luther Adams notated some bird songs out, and we will be playing those little chirps into the piece.
I really encourage the public to check out this production, a true Alaska rooted production at 2 p.m. on Saturday. It's free at the university outdoors.
And please be aware that the performance will encompass one of the parking lot segments, so there'll be people directing the parking. You know, please be aware that the parking will not be close to the three flagpoles because the performance space will be near that. Please just be alert for parking.
And the audience is mobile. They walk amongst the dozens of performers, and it should be a beautifully integrated experience for the musicians as well as for the audience. Well, thank you for being with us today
thank
and for being
so
part
much,
of Juno Jazz
thank
and
you.
Classics.
Thank
Let's
you.
Run over the schedule real quickly again. The President's Own Band plays at 4:30 at the Juno Arts and Humanities Center. It is free. Remember, you cannot enter Whittier Street from Egan. Tonight at 7 o'clock, the Third Coast Percussion Group plays at the Jack. And tomorrow evening at the Jack also is Maxine Pachmanoff and Roman Kim, and then followed by the dance party with the Rad Trads, and of course Mavis Staples, the inestimable Mavis Staples, concludes the 30th year of Juno Jazz and Classics, 7:30 p.m. at Centennial Hall. Thanks to Kathy Ruddy and to Dwayne and Corinne Corbin for being with us this afternoon.
Thank you so much.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 18th of May, 2016. It was on this day in 1860 in Chicago, the Republican National Convention, Abraham Lincoln was nominated for president. He was nominated in part because he took a moderate position on slavery. Two of his rivals, William Seward and Edward Bates, supported the complete eradication of slavery across the country. Lincoln was only in favor of curbing the expansion of slavery and limiting it to the South. And he had won over doubters from the East, Lincoln had, with his speech in New York City just 3 months before. 1,500 New Yorkers went to see him at Cooper Union. They were astonished at how awkward and ungainly Lincoln was, which then made them even more astonished at how articulate he was as a speaker. It's the birthday of Tina Fey, born in Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, 1970. Mother worked in a brokerage firm. Her father was a university grant proposal writer. She was a high school honor student in the drama club, performed in a summer theater group, went to the University of Virginia, studied playwriting and acting, moved to Chicago after college, 1992. She took night classes at the Improv Training Center, the Second City, worked at the YMCA during the day, then started performing with the Second City. She traveled around the country, did 8 shows a week. 3 years later, hired as a sketch writer for Saturday Night Live, and she quickly rose to head writer. Went on to write and star in her own comedy series, 30 Rock, came out with a memoir in 2011, Bossy Pants, went to number one on the New York Times bestseller list. And in response to people who said that women are not funny, Tina Fey said, "I don't like Chinese food, but I don't write articles trying to prove that it doesn't exist." It's the birthday of the director and film producer Frank Capra, born in Sicily in 1897, came to Los Angeles as a boy, worked odd jobs at the Columbia Studios, and began making his films in 1928. It Happened One Night, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, You Can't Take It With You, Arsenic and Old Lace, and It's a Wonderful Life in 1946. Frank Capra, who said, "I wanted to glorify the average man, not the guy at the top, not the politician, not the banker, just the ordinary guy whose strength I admire, whose survivability I admire." Here's a poem by Joe McDougall entitled "The Ferry." Whenever we needed to cross the Arkansas, we had to take the dirt road to the ferry. My father would drive, my mother would fret about missing the on-ramp, driving off the other end, getting caught by the dark. After we bumped ourselves on with a few other cars, after the ferry coughed us away from shore, the operator would shut the motor off to drift as long as he dared. Then we'd hear the motor again, arguing with the current. Thus, we kept our course, the river suffering us, the sun easing down, darkness closing over us, merciless as water. The Ferry, a poem by Joe McDougall from In the Home of the Famous Dead, published by the University of Arkansas Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. And by Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into challenging games. Learn more at lumosity.com. Engineered by Noah Smith, produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
This station receives support from Canyon Hydro, providing maintenance, inspection, and repair services to remote hydro producers with fly-in service available. Information about these services can be found at canyonhydro.com.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Lori Scandling here with you. And joining me is Molly Porter, as well as Lisa Penoyer from the Head Start program. Head Start's been in Juneau a long time, and we're also happy to have Nikki Love from the Association for the Education of Young Children. We're talking today about folks getting ready for Head Start. So, Molly, you're a 15-year experienced person with the Head Start program here in Juneau. What are key things that parents should know about getting a youngster enrolled in Head Start? For example, what are the age requirements and any other requirements that are fundamental to eligibility?
Absolutely, yes. We are looking currently for families that have children from the ages of 3 to 5, 3 by August 1st. And there is an application process as well.
Where can they find that? Is it something you can fill out online?
Absolutely. They can go to our website at rcchita.org and follow through services under families and then Head Start.
Great. Is there an income eligibility level that families should be able to document, or is there other documentation that will be required as part of that registration process?
Yes, along with the application, we do have several supporting documents needed, and income verification is one of them. We accept all applications and put through the application process. We do look for income-eligible families first that fall under the poverty guideline for the state of Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can accept over-income families up to about 49% of our overall.
So families should not feel that if their income is above that poverty guideline for Alaska, which is what, 150% or 200% of the federal
Correct.
Guideline, that their child won't get in. It's well worth their going through the application
Absolutely.
Process, it sounds like.
Absolutely.
And do they need a birth certificate or something to prove that their child is age 3 to 5 by August 1?
We do like to have a birth certificate on file, and that just shows the age of the child and or 3 prior to the designated date.
Mm-hmm. And when does the first day of school begin for Head Start? Does it follow a traditional academic year, and is it one morning hours each day, or is there a shift in the afternoon, one in the morning?
Okay, that's a very good question. Our first day of service for this upcoming school year for the 2016-17 year is September 6th. Our teachers will be on site at their centers the week of August 29th. So
they're available to meet families and
exactly.
children as they
right.
ease into that school
right.
year.
And our programs usually run full 3 to 4 hours a morning, 4 days a week.
Mm-hmm. And I was reading about Head Start, and I know in our local community, Head Start employs about 50 people. And I was thinking, that implies, at least, a very nice student-to-teacher ratio. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, currently our student-to-child ratio is 3 to 7. Excuse me, 1 to 7.
One yes. adult per 7.
Yes, 1 adult per 7 children. It could go up to 20 children in a classroom.
Lisa, I know that you are involved with Family and Community Partnerships for Head Start. And in reading about Head Start, it sounds like that is an emphasis, the partnership with the family. Talk about what kind of activities make up that family classroom partnership.
Okay. For Tlingit and Haida, we really focus on families first, and families being the first and most important teacher for their children. So we provide many opportunities for parents to come into the classroom, to volunteer, to spend time while their child is in class or before or after class. We also provide monthly parent trainings. So there are 9 parents meetings in the 9-month period that school's open. And the parents will be learning, like probably September would be focusing on safety and school bus safety and transportation safety. And so every month there's a different topic. It's very family-friendly, very child-friendly, but the real emphasis with Head Start is more and more is getting parents involved because they are the best and the first teacher of their children.
Are home visits by the lead teachers part of the program, Lisa?
They sure are. We have 4. They do 4 visits a year. 2 of them are actually in the home, and they set goals with the families. They ask them to come up with goals for a family project, and they also ask goals for their child's school readiness goals, what you want your child to learn about in school and at home. That can be interchanged. And then 2 of the visits are called parent-teacher conferences, and those are held at the school. So in the 9-month period, they'll have 2 home visits and then 2 parent-teacher conferences.
Molly, what's the emphasis on learning at this age in the Head Start program? Head Start has been around since the 1960s. What's the teaching approach in the classroom? What can one expect their child to learn?
Absolutely. We are a play-based program. Learning through their environment and also place-based for the community that they live in. So really being engaged in their age-appropriate learning within their community, within their environment.
So it's localized for the Correct. Wherever those youngsters live.
Correct.
Nikki, you're with the Association for the Education of Young Children. What kind of partnerships does the association have with Head Start and other early learning programs in our community?
Sure. Right now, AEYC houses what's called the Partnerships for Families and Children. And it's a group of 20 nonprofit organizations in Juneau that work with families with young kids. That includes Head Start, that includes Reach Infant Learning, Bartlett Beginnings, the Juneau Family Health and Birth Center, OCS. So we involve a lot of folks. And our role is to really help connect all the agencies, to share information, and to promote the programs that are going on and connect the families to those programs. So that's part of my role here with these great ladies, is to get the word out about early opportunities for kids.
So, Nikki, if a family, perhaps new to Juneau, had a variety of questions about what is available for my child, it sounds like AUYC might be a great place to start.
It would be a great place. And, in fact, the partnerships has its own website, and that is junofamilies.org. And there is a tab on there called the Juno Parent Bulletin. So that will immediately take you to information about, like, activities that are going on each month for kids, as well as different maybe program updates. Like we had an early learning fair recently, so you can find out about events and things.
One last question, Molly. What is the deadline to sign up for Head Start? When is the last possible moment that a family can have their application considered? It sounds like it's good to get it in as soon as possible because it's popular, but when's the cutoff?
We really don't actually have a cutoff. We recruit all year long. We really put in our heavy recruitment process this time of year. Definitely, we would like to try to get our centers full prior to the first day of service.
And you have, are there five centers, is that right?
We actually have quite a few centers along the southeast area, all the way from Yakutat to Prince of Wales.
How about in Juneau locally?
In Juneau, we do have five separate centers available.
Wonderful. We've been talking with Molly Porter and Lisa Penoyer of the Head Start program here in Juneau. And if you have a youngster who will be ages 3 to 5 by August 1st, consider Head Start, and you can find out more by going to the following website, CCTHITA, and that's for the Central Council of Tlingit Haida Indians of Alaska.org, and learn more about Head Start, which emphasizes play-based early learning. Those classes start on September 6th. Other questions, check out junofamilies.org for information as well from AEYC, and thanks to Nikki Love for representing that organization as well. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
Good night, Trish. Have a...
Well, speaking of families, Juno Afternoon has a set of guests with us right now that also emphasizes families, and that is the 4-H program. I'd like to welcome Darren Snyder and Sarah Lewis from the Cooperative Extension Service, as well as two youth who are here, Claire Boyle and Alex Sinclair, and we'll specifically talk about the 4-H opportunities that are coming up. You want to start, Darren, or have the our visitors?
Well, let me go ahead and lay a little bit of groundwork here. We have our camp coming up. It's called the Alaska Experience Camp,
and it's 4-H partnering up with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game to put on a really excellent camp that's been going on for quite a few years now. And we're just about full with all the slots in that camp, but we do have room for a few more middle school and high school age youth. And we've asked Alex and Claire to come in here today just to kind of share a little bit about why they about what they've enjoyed about camp, to let some other youth and maybe some parents out there know why specifically some young ladies, some girls might want to come to camp and have a great time out there.
Great. What are the dates? Let's get that out there.
The main camp is Monday, June 6th through the 10th.
All right. Alex or Claire, let's talk about the experience at camp and why you might recommend it for someone else.
Well, my personal favorite part of camp that other people tend to enjoy is there's usually some sort of adventure that always goes on. And oftentimes it includes shelter building, where you can build your own shelter, and it's sort of a sense of accomplishment to be able to build something that you can sleep in overnight. And also, one of my favorite things that I did last year was I taught a group of younger girls how to build a fire safely, responsibly, and fast. And so, yeah.
Alex, how about you?
I think my favorite parts were definitely the wild edible walks and Wild Chef, because, like, it's great that you can walk around your own city or town and know what you can eat and not just from, like, your own town. You don't have to store by it or anything.
Probably a lot of folks, young and not so young, are unaware of how much is edible in our very community. And, Sarah, I know you're with Cooperative Extension, and your emphasis is on the preservation of foods. I'm sure there are many, many foods that we are not aware of.
Yes, and we love to teach the kids about that. So out at the camp, we actually, like Alex was talking about, we do wild edibles walks, and while we're out there, we'll be doing things like beach greens and beach asparagus, and then we also cook them up. But what I really like about what both of these girls just talked about was this is a very broad camp. There are skills for everyone. For young as 11, for as old as 18, for girls and boys, and girls and boys doing all kinds of activities together, and lots of team building and lots of survival skills. And Claire's actually, full disclosure, Claire is my daughter, and she's been in this camp for a number of years before I even worked for Extension. And what I really like about it as the mother of an outdoor girl is she is really solid in her skills in the outdoors, which is important in Southeast Alaska.
How much is the camp, and is there some financial support if there are families listening who would like their young woman, their young man in their household to be more outdoor-oriented and confident in the outdoor, as each of you young women have talked about? If they'd like to have their child come and perhaps can't afford it, let's talk about that.
Yeah, it's a really reasonably priced camp at $225. This is a residential camp, so we provide transportation from downtown or the valley on out to, the camp is at the Eagle River Scout Camp, and so we go out to the trailhead there and hike in, and then we give transportation back as well. And so it's $225. We suggest that folks who are looking for a scholarship, looking for assistance, to start with the city and borough. Parks and Rec has a generous up to $100 waiver, and then after you've gone through that process, if you still need some additional assistance, then we do also have a through our 4-H funds, our leadership council can also help.
And a phone number or website for more information?
523-3280. And you can also find Juno 4-H on Facebook, and then also on our website if you just Google Juno 4-H.
Thank you so much for talking with Darren Snyder, as well as Sarah Lewis of the Cooperative Extension Program, about the upcoming 4-H Alaska Experience Camp, which will be offered along with Fishing Game June 6th through the 10th out at the Boy Scout Camp for middle and high school students. The cost is $225. There is help for that amount. And you can find out more by Googling Juno 4-H, and I want to thank Alex as well as Claire for sharing their experience at camp. Enjoy it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. This rhythmic whistled song is a quintessential sound of woodlands in the eastern U.S. But few birds are more ready to visit your backyard than its singer, the tufted titmouse. And it's a fine thing that they do, because a tufted titmouse has just about everything you could ask for in a backyard bird. Petite and strikingly elegant, it has a jaunty crest and a silver-hued back set off by salmon-orange flanks. Its snappy image adorns many a bag of birdseed. It's as perky as a chickadee. In fact, it's a cousin to the chickadee. And as it comes boldly to sample your seed or suet feeders, the tufted titmouse will even hang upside down like an acrobat. Like to see even more of your local titmice? Put up a nest box with a small opening. You might even see three birds attending the nest, as one of last year's brood sometimes stays on as a helper. But what's in that peculiar name, titmouse? Well, it turns out the name descends from two ancient Anglo-Saxon root words. Tit, from a word meaning something small, and mouse, from a word applied to any small bird, as well as that little rodent. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Support for this station comes from the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, located at 1619 Glacier Avenue in downtown Juneau, offering aqua aerobics on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. until 12 p.m., and stretch aquatics on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 a.m. until 11:45 a.m. Schedules are available online at juneau.org/parkrec/pool. More information at 586-5325.
Well, we definitely have a family-oriented number of guests today. With me in the studio now is Sean Isley of Discovery Southeast and Sarah Tarver from Juneau Parks and Recreation. And they're here to talk about Kids to Parks Day, which is this Saturday, May 21st, at the Eagle Valley Center, which is at about 25 mile out by Amalga Harbor, and it runs from 10 to 2. Tell us a little bit about the purpose of this day and how folks can get involved if they want to.
Well, the purpose of this is to get families and people out in nature and to learn how to appreciate it and know that it's right outside and to enjoy it while you can. And there's always opportunities out there for some type of adventure, and it's a lot of fun. And this is trying to enhance all of that.
So, Sean, you're with Discovery Southeast, which tells me there will be some interesting activities going on. Why don't you talk about Discovery Southeast's role in Kids to Parks Day this Saturday?
Yeah, thanks. As you know, Discovery Southeast's mission is to deepen our connection with nature through education and exploration. We're well known for our nature studies programs in the local 3rd, 4th, and 5th grade classrooms. We also have summer camps and a ton of enrichment activities. And I guess we're kind of doing this as an enrichment activity. It's just a great way to encourage families to get outdoors and spend time, particularly in a park. The Eagle Valley Center is a gorgeous location. But, you know, the idea of this is really any park, anywhere you want to go outside, is just a great opportunity to spend some quality time with your family, whether that's just taking a walk even on a rainy afternoon or what looks like a gorgeous sunny Saturday coming up in the forecast to spend out at the Eagle Valley Center.
What kind of activities will be offered?
Oh, thanks. We'll have some naturalists there from Discovery Southeast, so we'll be doing some walks that that kids or families can go on. And I think CBJ is going to have some great activities going on right at the Eagle Valley Center itself. And then, you know, above and beyond has kayak rentals out there. And they've actually offered free kayak rentals. I think there's a 10:30 slot and a noon slot. It might be 10 or 12:30, but The details are online at discoverysoutheast.org, and if people want to book a free kayak rental for this Saturday during those times, they can go online and see the details and give Above and Beyond a call.
The ocean is just right over the hill, really, from the house there, and so it's quite close. That sounds exciting. Sarah, what kind of activities will Parks and Rec be offering?
We'll have some arts and crafts, as well as we'll be offering water and some sort of snack for people out there. And again, the hikes will be going on and the kayak rentals, but mainly arts and crafts by the house there.
Do people need to attend for all 4 hours to participate, or can it be a drop-in?
It's a drop-in. Anytime is great. And, you know, the idea of Kids to Parks Day is really to get out and spend time with the family. So this is a great opportunity to come out to the Eagle Valley Center, but really in the spirit of the day, just taking some time in this gorgeous weather and going out to a park is a great opportunity.
And it's free.
That's right. Mm-hmm. We have another free opportunity. Can I mention that coming up this
Please
summer?
Please do.
There is a rebound trip that Discovery Southeast is doing with Aware, and that's a kayak trip for teenagers. We're doing it in early July, and it's a great opportunity to spend a week kayaking in Northern Lynn Canal. It's open to any high school-age teenager. There actually is a cost for the trip, but we've budgeted a ton of scholarships for any family that needs one. So it's just a great opportunity for local families to get out, and they can also, just like Kids to Parks Day, they can find out more about this rebound trip at discoverysoutheast.org.
Sean, thanks so much. We're talking with Sean Isley from Discovery Southeast, as well as Sarah Tarver from Juneau Parks and Rec, about a free opportunity this Saturday out at the Eagle Valley Center, which is off the road to Imelga Harbor. But between 10 and 2, there will be arts and crafts, as well as free kayaking and nature hikes on the Kids to Parks Day. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll be sitting in the evening, watching the ships roll in, and I'll watch them roll away. Yeah. I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide.
Thanks for staying aboard Juneau Afternoon. Lori Scandling here, and our final guests this afternoon include Carl Yucatel, who is our harbor master, and Chris Myrtle, who is with Corvus Designs. We're going to talk about the Harbors Upland Master Plan, and I'd like you to describe exactly what the purpose of the plan is and what area it covers. Carl, can you start with that, please?
Yeah, so thank you for having us today. And basically what we want to do is look at very comprehensively and very holistically look at the uplands from Bridge Park to Norway Point, or where the yacht club is. And we want to look out the next 5, 10, 20 years and start planning for the future, start planning for what's best for the boating community, the maritime community in Juneau, and what we can do to really move the Juneau harbors forward. And so it's a planning exercise that I think will reap great rewards. It'll be it's a roadmap for the future of how we provide economic opportunities for the harbors.
So I have a two-part question related to that area then. Carl, as harbor master, what isn't working right about that area when it comes to being a harbor?
Well, I would probably say, what can we improve on? So, you know, we have a harbor that boats can come in and leave, and they're safe and secure. But, you know, if your listeners would think to other harbors they've visited throughout Alaska, you know, pick a Seward, where in Seward, the harbor is really the focal point of that town. And in Juneau, we really don't have that. And I'd like to bring, you know, that activity, that enthusiasm into our harbors. You know, we can do that, I think, with smart planning, smart infrastructure investment, you know, mixed-use buildings, restaurants, hardware stores, things like that that are lacking in our existing facilities.
And Chris, you're a landscape architect.
Mm-hmm.
From your point of view, what's missing from that area?
Well, I think as Carl hit up, right now, the harbor's uplands, and the uplands is everything out of the water. Right now, all that is doing is supporting the existing harbor. So for the most part, it's parking. It's an awful lot of unorganized, unmanaged parking to a certain degree. There is a small marine service yard there, but it's very small. We've got UAS there. They're a partner, of course, that's involved. You've got a lot of people who are all there, but they're not really talking with each other. They're not really figuring out ways how they can be consolidated and create partnerships so that we have a limited amount of land. How can we make the best use of the land? And as Carl said, you know, we obviously need to support the needs of the people that are down at the harbors, whether they're recreation boarders, the fishing fleet, people that are on liveaboards.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, as Carl hit on, you know, it's a great opportunity to create some opportunities that will provide economic opportunities. So whether it be a fish market, how can we get some hardware stores? How we can expand perhaps the marine service yard? What are some other opportunities that the waterfront isn't something on the other side of Egan Drive, but it really becomes a destination within the community? How do we get people down there to buy fish? How do we make it more fun to come down there and watch your kids go sailing? How can we really make it a vibrant part of the community? Because right now we're doing it with the Seawalk going around. But, you know, hats off to Docks and Harbors for realizing that we can do so much more with our harbor uplands than just parking. So it's really going to be bringing everybody together. And as a landscape architect, you know, this is the type of work I really like doing, is the master plan, getting all the ideas from all the people, hearing all these great ideas, and how do we really get them all to be a consolidated, comprehensive design solution?
How does that process begin? What's the first step, and how can folks get involved?
Well, it actually starts tonight, and what we're doing tonight is we're doing our visioning. So what's happened is we have a team. So Corvus Design is leading the team. We also have P&D engineers on the team. They've done a lot of works with the harbors, the actual in-water harbor improvements. We also have Northwind Architects on our team and Raincoast Data. And we've all been doing background research and analysis, and we're going to present some findings. What are some opportunities that we can do? So Melani, for example, is going to talk about economic opportunities. What currently isn't being served in Southeast Alaska? So what can we do to make the Juneau Harbors a premier port in Southeast? What are some of these opportunities that aren't being captured elsewhere that we can then emphasize and hopefully bring opportunities, bring jobs, bring a vibrant waterfront to Juneau? So we've all done our background research. We're going to be presenting that tonight at the Yacht Club at 6:30. And then what we want is community input. People say, hey, by the way, I live down here. We really need to concentrate on this area. This is an area that isn't a problem, or this is a great opportunity. What could we do possibly with the large uplands around the Yacht Club? Maybe we need to put a little bit more fill into the channel to create some more uplands for development so that we can really create that vibrant waterfront that Carl has been alluding to. So tonight will be visioning. We're going to give a little bit of a presentation about what our recommendation, not our recommendation, but what our findings are. But really, it's a listening. So we want to hear from people, whether your kids go sailing and 4-H, whether you live on the boats, whether you buy fish down there, or whether you just like to walk the docks and look at the boats. So we're really looking for how can we make something that meets the needs of the community, meets the needs of the users, and provides new opportunities for the community. So we're really looking to get that input and figure out what are the priorities and needs, and then we'll work those in and figure out and prioritize those and start master planning them into the site.
So give us a sneak preview, one takeaway from the surveys, research, and data collection that have occurred in preparation for tonight's meeting.
Well, I think probably, Carl, and you can back me up on this one or give me a different opinion, but I think Melanie came up with some pretty surprising numbers about how strong the fishing industry really is in Juneau and the amount of jobs it provides in Juneau. It was much higher than I think we both realized. So that's definitely an opportunity that we should continue to pursue and definitely support. We don't want another community to start stealing those jobs away from us. So I think that was one thing that we're all pleasantly surprised to see. But there's a few other things that's worth coming down. But because this is the visioning, it is really important that the community come down, just even if it's just spending a little bit of time, and just tell us what you would like to see on the waterfront. Because if we don't hear it now, we're going to move forward in the master plan. There'll be other opportunities to comment. We'll have a couple other public meetings where we'll have public input. But really, now's the time to get those great ideas incorporated into the master plan.
Carl, were you surprised by data that showed how strong the fishing industry is in Juneau, or did it reinforce something that you as our harbor master knew?
Well, I think I did realize that commercial fishing is an important leg of our economy. You know, we're no longer just a government town. We're a tourism town. We're a commercial fisher town. You know, we've got the two very vibrant fish processing plants in town that hire a lot. They have a lot of employees. Surprising number of employees. So yeah, it reconfirmed what I thought in the back of my mind.
Let's talk just momentarily, if we can, about the waterfront plan that, as Carl, we chatted earlier, began with some master planning in 2008. So we are 8 years down the road in the waterfront master plan. What still remains to happen for the waterfront that reaches the bridge?
Yeah, so you're talking about the 2004 long-range waterfront plan. And again, that's these plans, they're kind of designed to be inspirational. So it's not like, at this date this will happen, but what these comprehensive plans allow is just kind of a roadmap, as I mentioned earlier, to see things through fruition. And it's helpful when they go before the Planning Commission of whether something fits, you know, that you do have these, that you tease out these plans in a public setting. And things like when you do have a solid document, things just go much better.
And are we close to completing the downtown waterfront plan been approved?
I mean, there's still a lot of seawalk to be done. There was a mega yacht harbor that was envisioned in that 2004 document. So there's a lot more that could be done in that long-term waterfront plan. But again, what we're just looking at, I'll call it an inspirational document is what we want. And I think that if we do it right, we will have people, the community behind it, and say, yeah, that's what we want. We want this draw at the harbors. We want a place where we can have bands on Friday afternoons. And we want to have, you know, that we've thought this through. And we haven't just said, oh, here's 1,500 square feet of land. Let's put a building here. Let's put a bathroom here. No, they all fit together. There's a synergy if you do it right.
We're talking with Chris Myrtle of Corvus Designs, as well as our harbor master, Carl Uchitel, about preparing a harbor's upland master plan. There is a visioning session this evening at 6:30 at the Yacht Club. Chris, if someone cannot come this evening, you mentioned there will be a couple other opportunities, but is there a way to weigh in online?
Yeah, most certainly. If you go through the Docks and Harbors website, we do have a website set up specifically for the project where you can provide comments, and we will definitely be hitting the streets and letting people know about the next couple of meetings coming up.
All right. Thanks for joining me today.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast.